maybe you've noticed the stairs, the groceries, everything that's not as easy as they used to be. And you're starting to wonder, what would it look like to get a little help? At Care.com, asking for support doesn't mean giving up independence. The right kind of help lets you stay in charge. Whether you know what kind of care you need or you're just starting to look, Care.com is here to help. You can find background-checked in-home caregivers who fit your budget, or explore senior living communities at your own pace. Read reviews, request tours, compare options. And if it all feels overwhelming, our senior care advisors, all master's-level social workers, can help you create a plan. For a limited time, use the code LISTEN20 for 20% off your initial Care.com subscription. That's LISTEN20, all one word, good for 20% off. Start your senior care journey with confidence.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. We have a great show tonight, as always. We have two different segments. And before we get started with our first segment, and you're really going to enjoy our first guest, you're going to enjoy all of them. But before doing that, got to remind you to like the stream. It's a very easy way to support the show. Give it a thumbs up. Also, if you haven't already, please subscribe. Subscribe and then hit the bell. That way you won't miss any of these streams. And also, if you can, please do support the show at Patreon, patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. And coming up soon on Patreon, you'll be getting early access to a little interview that I did with none other than Jeremy Corbyn. So many, many reasons to join the Patreon. If you can afford it at $5 a month, that's when you get the extra access, extended interviews. If you can't afford that, you can still support the show and make it happen, because we really couldn't make it happen without your support at the $1 a month level. That's just $12 a year. And again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. So during the second portion of tonight's show, we're going to be speaking to Lauren Steiner and Nadia Ahmad about how they organized a secret surprise protest at the DNC, and also why Nadia is filing a complaint, or actually already did file a complaint with Chicago police against the Democratic National Committee. But we are first joined by someone making his Katie Helper Show debut, Ash Prashar, who is a formerly incarcerated political strategist, human rights activist, and writer. And he is working on a bunch of really important initiatives and efforts related to the genocide that's happening right now in Palestine. And he's worked with politicians of various parties, but he's calling them all out right now for their complicity in genocide. So welcome, Ash. How are you?
Hi, great to be on. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And I hear you have a hype man, a little a cheerleader.
Yeah, he's running out the door as we speak.
Okay, yeah. Well, I think he's just probably giving you he's trying to pump you up for tonight's interview.
So totally.
We thank him for his enthusiasm. So we have so many things to talk to you about, but let's start off with a really important and interesting campaign that you've been working on called No Tax for Genocide. So please tell people about this.
Yeah, like the US, the UK like has significant responsibility under like international law to prevent a genocide, right? We both know we're all signed up to these acts that are the UN, but also in the UK's case, they're signed up to the Rome Statute of the ICC. So they are under real like orders effectively by laws they've passed to actually prevent what's going on in Palestine right now. And they, like the US, have provided cover for Israel. They've continued to provide material support. And until the beginning of the year, everyone like here was protesting. You know, there was direct action, of course. Some of the biggest direct action that's been happening in our collective movement has been in the UK. You've seen all the weapons factories shut down, the Elbit ones in the UK. But people are frustrated, right? What more can they do? So we discovered, using international law, but also UK law that they've actually enshrined, that you can legally withhold your tax in the United Kingdom if they are committing or aiding and abetting in war crimes or crimes against humanity, one of which is genocide. So one of those laws happened to be the ICC Act itself, which says they are, you know, that you cannot aid and abet a war crime, you cannot aid and abet genocide or ethnic cleansing. And the second act that makes the connection to tax is the Terrorism Act, because the Terrorism Act isn't just like what we assume is terrorists, a single act of, you know, blows up a bus or whatever. Terrorism is also a state, an organization, something like that, that can actually be complicit in those war crimes. So in this case, Israel. So, and whatever the interesting thing about tax, as you know, groups can be funded. Let's say the US's favorite example is you know, Middle East organizations funded by Iran. They keep mentioning how they're backed by Iran, that Iran does this, Iran funds this, Hezbollah, whatever, right? And they use that to sanction Iran, right? They use that to sanction a country that the taxpayer has no, you know, no potential opinion or has any influence over what their government backs. Well, those laws can be used against the UK themselves. So the UK taxpayer is now currently complicit in aiding and abetting a genocide. And actually, because of these two acts, they don't have to aid and abet in that genocide. In fact, they can actually hold their government to account. And what, how we do it is you don't stop paying your tax. You withhold it. It goes into a trust that the government will have access to when they stop aiding and abetting a genocide. So you're actually still contributing. It's in a trust that the government will have access to, but they will need to prove to citizens that they are no longer aiding, abetting, supporting, or being complicit in this genocidal action.
And so what do people who want to participate in this in the UK do? And then tell us the relevance of this for the American audience.
Right. So what the UK do, I mean, a lot of people right now just have to sign up. There's a website for notaxforgenocide.co. And like they just sign up right there. And what they do at that point is just say they're interested in doing this. And the easiest people who can sign up are freelancers, of course, because you have to file your own taxes, independent contractors, small businesses. You're in control of your relationship with government. The complicated relationship where we need to support people is people who are payee, which is effectively your employer, like takes your tax out and submits it to the government, right? There is a complicated relationship there about you having to inform your employer you don't want to pay tax, and you know, we will help people through that. The reason this is important for people in the US, and I know the laws don't apply directly over here, right? But we're at that point where the more alienated we can make the United States and Israel, the more alone they can feel on the global stage. It's really important. Right now, when you hear people like Kirby and Matt Miller and even President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris say that the international coalition there to support Israel. Well, let's just be real. It's the US, Australia, and a handful of countries in Europe. It's not an international coalition. As we chip them away, the US is alone in this support. As Kamala Harris said at the convention, you know, they will support them whatever, come hell or high water, they will support them, right? So the more we can make them feel alone, and politically and militarily, the more powerful any resistance to this action against Palestinians is, right? So if Britain pulls out, maybe ports shut down. It's already happening in Southern Europe, right? Italians won't dock. The unions are leading that, not the government. Spain won't dock. The government is actually saying they will not dock its Israeli ships, right? And then you see what's happening with Yemen in the Red Sea. So you're already seeing that what impact that's having in the Israeli economy. Now, the two big allies to the United States and Israel are Germany and the UK. And if we can cut them off, because these laws also apparently apply in Germany too, right? If we can do this there as well, right? It leaves the US alone on an island. And maybe they want that, and that's fine. But the reality is, diplomatically, we will have no say. We'll never be able to mobilize people like you behind the Ukraine in the future or any other action we want in the world, because we're alone participating, aiding and abetting in this genocide.
Right. And it, of course, as we've pointed out several times on this show and others have, this is actually, the United States is violating the Leahy Law, which says that you cannot give material support to governments that are violating human rights. Obviously, we violate the Leahy Law constantly.
And the irony is, like, we are, well, I have a thing. I think the US is effectively trying to trial a new run of international law. I reckon they are currently ripping up every norm we have, every law we have, and seeing what we're willing to accept. I mean, that's where we're at with this right now. We're in a place where I think they're trying to rewrite law and the societal norms right now in front of us. And it's up to us to resist in every way possible to stop that happening, right? While I don't agree, while I don't believe these international laws written after World War II, the majority of them were written for the global South or written for, frankly, the citizen. They were written for the powerful governments that won that war to protect, to make sure nothing ever happened that they couldn't control. There is power and radical action in using those laws against those individuals and maintaining them and rewriting them in a shape that represents all our global needs, not the US's push for this. They are basically showing that none of it means anything right now and trying to rewrite what's acceptable to us. Like, we want it to be acceptable, those images that we're seeing out of Gaza right now. They want it to beheaded children. They want to say that this is all in the name of self-defense, and whatever language they use to justify it is normal. And the reality is, like, we need to resist our governments more here. Because look, I truly believe, like, what the people who are going to protect Palestinians on the ground is the resistance. Like, and that's whether it be Hamas, Hezbollah, all the rest of the groups that do that, they will protect Palestinians in the end. Our sole job is to resist our governments, to shut things down, to make sure that our governments cannot aid a bet, so our public is not complicit in these atrocities taking place in Palestine right now. And that is should be our primary goal as a society, is to shut everything down to make sure we don't support this.
You know, it's fascinating because you are very bold and you don't pull your punches and you don't mince words when you're talking about what's happening in Palestine, when you're talking about the resistance. And people may be surprised that you've worked with people like Boris Johnson and Barack Obama. Tell people about your personal political trajectory and journey, I guess, starting off with the incarceration.
Yeah, so I was incarcerated at 17. I stole a bunch of stuff from a store called Harvey Nichols in the UK, which is kind of like the Saks of the UK, if people want to know, if we want to reference it. You know, I came from a broken home and, like, effectively a bunch of kids doing stupid stuff. And I was sentenced to a year for theft, which was egregious. But, you know, anyone who knows the US justice system knows that it punishes brown and black kids a lot more than it punishes other kids. And the UK is the same, right? We were sentenced to a year. And it was because of my grandparents and my aunt who fought to get me out. I was out in 4 months. They fought the justice secretary. Ironically, the justice secretary working for Tony Blair, who ended up being one of my future bosses at the time, to make sure to argue that the sentence was too much and he had a good family home to come home to and we'll take care. Because of my grandfather, I met this amazing author called Donald James. He wrote loads of books about growing up working class in World War II. And one of his book launches, I met a former editor, and I was only 19 at this point, or 20, just about to turn 20, a former editor of the Sun newspaper in the UK. And that editor, my granddad did the whole, like, he just threw me in front of him and said, so he wants a job. And in that room, the guy didn't ask what I did. You know, he just said to me, you know, we all make mistakes. Do you want to come work at the Sun in a couple of weeks? And it was like the thing that changed my life. And it's ironic because I think when we think about who believes in progressive policies, I think sometimes we are so easy to pitch people as a group and how they believe it, not individuals. Like, this guy was Rupert Murdoch's right-hand man in the UK. And yet he was a working class white kid that grew up in Essex, really poor. Like, the last working class, like, kind of editors of that generation. Now everyone goes to Oxbridge, right? Like, now, like, you don't get that kind of, like, connection to the working class. But, like, he just saw a kid who made a mistake, right? And because of him, I ended up going to, and this is someone who's, my family's not conservative. I, you know, very progressive. But, like, I had a criminal record. So I followed my boss. He went on to be David Cameron's director of communications. I was then ended up being a press officer. And he threw me on Boris Johnson's first mayoral election campaign in 08 and just said, don't F it up, you know? And it was my first shot and we won. You know, in London, which is not a very conservative city. As you know, you just interviewed Jeremy Corbyn. It's not a conservative city at all. But, you know, we ran on, like, a very progressive platform for a conservative at the time, right, in 08, right? It was a different time, I think, pre-Brexit in the UK. And that changed my stars, you know, doing that. You know, I came out here, worked on the first Obama campaign. And I went home, and this is, I think, the war criminal touch where I got my first experience of really understanding Israel-Palestine. Was I got a job working for Tony Blair, first as in his organization when he did a lot of governmental work in West Africa, but then to work for him as the Middle East Peace Envoy. And it's the first time I experienced Palestine, and I was sent there. I did a lot of work based in the UK first, a lot of work in the wider region. But then I got to spend a great deal of time between Tel Aviv and the West Bank for 3 months And I saw apartheid. I saw apartheid firsthand. And, you know, once you see it, you don't go back. And you make a choice, right? I having been through oppression and incarceration myself, understanding what the systems do to me, watching that happen to ordinary citizens on the street was just not in my DNA. I could not sit there and take it, and I resigned. It's very easy to continue going blindly into this stuff. But then at that point, I was, you know, I had enough. Like, I couldn't sit there and go there. And even the work itself, I realized over time, you know, we'd do meetings with the PA, we'd do meetings with Israel, and we'd never really communicate what the PA wanted, right, to anyone. And it really never mattered. So it was already playing out, and then seeing it firsthand on the ground, it was just too much. So I left my post. Since then, done a whole bunch of other campaigns, from justice reform and other political leaders. I worked on the last presidential campaign for the current war criminal, you know, Joe Biden. So, you know, worked for Michael Blake, who is, as a lot of people know, was the vice chair of the DNC, worked to get out the mobilize 4 million incarcerated people to actually vote for Biden because of the whole, you know, his history with that space, with the crime bill. Clearly won. I'm not saying that to me, it was just a great campaign at a pivotal moment where I think everybody, I don't think Biden won the campaign. I think everybody in the grassroots won the campaign because they were so horrified by the alternative. But the reason I went back to what I'm doing in Palestine is just have a unique experience with it. I have luckily still tons of diplomatic connections, both in Europe and the United States. And, you know, for me, it's really important really early to challenge the narrative. You know, what you're doing and what everybody else is doing is fighting back. Challenge the narrative, because the reality is, it was just up to our broadcasters, as you know, everyone would think Israel is the victim of, like, constant attacks from everybody else. It's literally social media, people, journalists on the ground in Gaza, and people fighting on shows like this and everything else and talking about what's actually happening and who actually is committing crimes. That's the only reason that we are seeing a balanced view of this, a real view.
And so what were some of the most shocking, disturbing, important things that you saw when you were in Palestine?
I mean, the checkpoints, right? Like, that's the part. It just reminds me of prison. Mm. I know there's so much more. I mean, I saw someone get assaulted for no reason. They just explained to me that the person was, like, didn't have the right ID. But, like, why are you assaulting the person at the checkpoint? Like, you're dragging him. Like, and we're, like, flying through on diplomatic cars. And, like, I'm like, I can see this. This is insane. You know, and also just watching the actual construction of settlements, like seeing it happen in the territory that's supposed to be, if you did believe, I mean, I don't believe in two states, but if you did believe in two states, which is supposed to be Palestinian territory, and you're seeing these, and the UN body that were there, you know, the Middle East Peace Envoy, just turning a blind eye to this and letting it happen, not objecting, actually going, okay, this is cool, but not again. Like, not again. I mean, how many other times was it already happening? This is 2011. This is way back then. I mean, as you know, it's accelerated rapidly since then. But it was so obvious to me. The checkpoints to me was one of the most, because obviously we are protected when we're working for that. So we're like in a specific crew of people and like taken everywhere we are with UN officials or like Middle East Peace Envoy officials. But going there on the ground, like the times you could see it was the checkpoints because we were flying through and you could see the assault. You could see people getting assaulted. Like it was like, there was no reason that every checkpoint I could see over the course of those 3 months, I could see skirmishes between people. And I'm saying skirmishes, I mean that as in like IDF attacking innocent civilians.
Right. It's not really
ripping hijabs off women. It's not a skirmish.
Right.
You know, it's literally IDF bullying women. It's like, you know, kicking stuff at children. It was one guy getting hit by the butt of a gun. I'm like, this is insane. It's happening at every checkpoint. And I just couldn't, for the life of me, once I started looking into it myself when I was on the ground, talking to Palestinians that I was working with, you know, once they knew that I wasn't like totally the enemy, they were like, oh, this is what's really happening. You know, because I think, like every person, naively, in my 20s, you know, the late 20s, I wanted to think I was going there to do something good, you know?
Right.
And then when you see on the ground, you're like, oh, the system really doesn't want to help Palestinians here.
And what did you see working inside the system that was most shocking to you, most disturbing, the thing that you really want people to know about, you know, having worked with Boris Johnson or Joe Biden?
Yeah, I mean, it's the law doesn't mean anything to them. Right, the law literally doesn't mean anything to them. And the scary thing for me is we as a society can accept that's what the right is like, but the reality is it's everybody, right? I mean, look, I chose to go work for Tony Blair knowing he did a rap, right? But I thought I'd make a difference. I thought, oh, the UN's overseeing this. We're going to go do this and going to make a difference. But even then, the politicians were more powerful than the UN body that could actually enforce anything, right? They were like, well, no, there's nothing to see here. The law is meaningless to them, and it is one law for them and one law for the rest of us. I think that is the most scary thing here. It's the gaslighting that you're seeing today with Palestine playing out in real terms. They've been doing this for years. It's just that there was no counterpoint, right? And I think the reality is what they're willing to rip up to create what I call a new norm, a new society, is really, really scary. Like the fact that we have AI unregulated weapons that US and the UK and Germany are making, assassinating just any human they see in Gaza. I think when you see those press conferences with the State Department, it's like, we'll look into it. We're going to get the IRF to go. I mean, this is like criminal intent happening in front of us. And I'd say pre-9/11, but the acceleration of this is 9/11, right? When we accepted Iraq was going to happen, when we accepted illegality, we have basically allowed we've allowed a path for this to continue. We marched. I remember the UK, 2 million people, Jeremy Corbyn was the anti-war protester, marched to say no to this. That was not in our name at all. Still went ahead with it, right? And the fact is, people went home. They knew people would go home eventually. And I think the difference between Gaza in this is Iraq, we didn't see the atrocities till years later, right? I remember those famous pictures published in the Mirror by one Piers Morgan, who is a complete racist, but the reality is he was a good editor of a newspaper and broke the story on some of the torture happening in Gaza, in Iraq. If it wasn't for those, we would never have known about some of that stuff till WikiLeaks and way later, frankly. And those pictures like shocked the world. Now we see them hourly, and yet they've done so much of it and not responded to our calls to this to stop. They are trying to create a new norm where this is acceptable. Abu Ghraib was unacceptable, and still we continued a bit, but like people were at least at the soldier level held accountable, not at the political level.
Right.
Like we're never, and the fact is they thought, okay, so politicians have got away with it. And I would argue that Barack Obama caused some of that. I would argue that like the forgiveness post his election of water under the bridge. If you don't hold people accountable for their war crimes, then you're never going to hold them accountable now. So it's up to the public right now. It's up to us to resist and hold our politicians accountable. And this is an everyday action, right? Like I know people think it's stupid to like harass and harangue and make them feel isolated. But like somebody said to me once, like, you know, what about their kids if people are standing outside their house? I'm like, what are you not watching? Kids in Gaza's heads being blown off right now in front of your eyes? Why should I care about Matt Miller's kids, Anthony Blinken's kids, Joe Biden's family? Why should Naomi Biden have a peaceful time in New York and go out partying when her father is literally massacring children by like the bucket load at this point, right? Because they're being weighed. Like, because there's no body left. Like, this is exactly the mentality they have. So why should they know peace? Why should their families know peace? That's what we should extend it to. The resistance should be against making their life and making it. Because kind of also say, people go to me, it's not the officials, it's not the extended. Like, we would never forgive the Nazis like this. We look back now, I know people be like, it's every one of them. It would have been every one of them. Right? The same people right now who deny that any of these other people are responsible. And that's including the AOCs and the progressive wing of the party, right? And that includes all those people who've claimed and feigned that they care about Palestinians over these years. They are all complicit in this, and they should never know peace. And they should never be welcome in institutions. Never, if possible, if they are going for employment office, shouldn't be getting jobs, be appointed on arts boards and things like that that they love to do. And in the end, and some of the things we're working on in Europe, hold them accountable legally. And that's the most important thing, right? We want to make sure we're going to send a message in the end that they will actually be held legally accountable as war criminals wherever they step in the world outside the United States of America. Because unfortunately, our Supreme Court has passed something that allows them to get away with all of this recently. But the most powerful thing about that, about radical use of the law, Katie, is that that means foreign courts, which have always been nervous about going after another citizen's politician, because it should be up to that court domestically to go after them. Look at that Supreme Court ruling and say, okay, now you can prosecute them. And that's a really powerful use of that law that they think will protect them.
Yeah. And of course, you made me think of Obama, when he said, when you mentioned Obama, you made me think of how he said, yeah, we tortured some folks.
I mean, it's like mind-blowing that it's so easy for him to say that, right? The guy who droned, what was it, every 20 minutes droned somebody in the Middle East? Like, it shows to me that, like, he never cared about any real settlement there. He never really cared about the people in the Middle East. It was just about being elected. And you can see the same with the future of the Democrats, right? We have AOC standing on a stage and yet, like, saying all the things she can about supporting Israel, like all that, had the chance to call for an arms embargo while she was up there or stopping it all. But then, and then the next day does like interviews with Gen Z correspondents saying, I wanted, like, you know, on a ceasefire, you know, like the bullshit, depending on what audience she's talking to, she can't hide it forever. Like, and it's not just her, it's the whole progress. It's her staff. It's her, like, it's the people who work for her, chief of staff. It's the progressive people that people like Waleed Shaheed. Like, these people are like undermining everything the Palestinian movement cares for. I mean, you only have to look at the debacle with the DNC, right? How are you gonna sit there and like have these progressive people helping you as the uncommitted vote, right? And then there's people gonna come on and talk about that, right? But at the same time, they're like they're basically saying Israel has the right to defend itself.
Right.
Like AOC, I think she FaceTimed one of the leaders of the uncommitted vote while he was down. She was like 100 feet away in the bloody event. Why couldn't she walk down there? Like, these people are complicit and they are not your friends.
Right.
My time in politicians is like, we have made them like celebrity. We have made them like rock stars of the 70s and 60s before us and 80s before us. We idolize people who don't actually care about us. They are there to keep a job. Like anybody else in society, right? They're there to keep a job and they'll say what they need to do to keep that job. And until people realize that, they're going to continue to, like, the fanboy club around, like, the AOCs and, like, even President Obama still has a massive fan club. Like, this, like, they can do no wrong. Like, where have we lost our critical thinking on this? Like, do you all have to experience trauma and oppression yourself to realize, wow, they can be bad?
Yeah, it's really disgusting. And one of the cool projects that you're working on, and which gives money to a very good cause, by the way, is you have these war criminal playing cards. And what's interesting is I didn't even remember this. So let's take a look at this, because this was inspired by some really disgusting playing cards that were created around the war in Iraq.
Yes. When 2003, President Bush's military created a deck of cards that British and American soldiers were handed. And those deck of cards had Saddam Hussein's face on them and all his leadership. And the goal of those deck of cards was to hunt, capture, and kill those people. Effectively, US soldiers would go out there and look at them, and if someone looked like them, they would shoot them. They weren't even like that good at trying to find any of these individuals. They would just shoot people they'd get away for crimes because they'd say, oh, well, he looked like one of the playing cards. So when this started, immediately I connected with a few old friends of mine. I was like,
and by the way, let me just add that as of 2021, all but four of the 52 most wanted of those Iraq criminals have either died or been captured. And that was created by the U.S. Defense Intelligence.
Yeah. So you can see that, like, it was, you know, and they were actually, it's so funny because when Gaza started, it was the 20th anniversary of those cards.
Right.
Literally. The week before Gaza, it was September 30th. It was the 20th. So they're like, I saw that. And I have colleagues in the UK who still have a deck of cards who serve in the UK service. I'm like, oh my God. So I wanted to create something originally for the media so they would understand who was behind the war crimes that we're seeing in Gaza right now, in Palestine right now. So I create this deck of cards effectively. This is it was designed by a Palestinian. That's the box. And it has effectively all the people from the US war cabinet, the Israeli war cabinet, but also spokespeople who literally create consent for these crimes. Matt Miller, you know, Kareem, you know, and also people who carry water for this genocide. People like Hillary, who went on TV and spread mass rape hoax lies, literally have done that, right? Foreign leaders who've been out there spreading these lies. So, you know, yes, it's obvious to have people like Antony Blinken, like, on one of these cards.
There we got it.
But, you know, why shouldn't Matt Miller be held responsible for this? Why shouldn't he, for the rest of his life, be known as a war criminal? Why shouldn't, you know, John Kirby, who is everybody's most detestable human being, be known as a war criminal? And the reason the spokespeople mean so much to me, as someone who was a former press secretary and communications director, one of the most disgusting things about Iraq was Nicole Wallace in the US and Alistair Campbell in the UK rewriting reports to claim there was WMDs.
Right.
They knowingly went there. Neither of them has ever seen a day of justice. Neither of them has ever been prosecuted for their crimes. And they created the consent.
And Nicole Wallace is on MSNBC.
Yes, 100%. And Nicole has a show. Alistair Campbell is like loved in the UK. It's kind of like he's rewritten his history. Like he had nothing to do with these war crimes. Both of them, and it's about the Obama comment earlier on, when you let those war crimes pass, you allow for the next generation of comms director to create consent. They can literally lie to your face. They are lying to every journalist as they stand at the podium of the State Department. They are lying to the public, but they are let out there unchallenged, saying all these things that happened around October 7th, giving no context from before, and being allowed to create consent amongst our public for these horrific crimes that we're seeing in Gaza today. And the reality is that, you know, some of the things with these cards. So when we were originally created for the media, I realized really quickly that a lot of the US media didn't care. They didn't want to, you know, there are people like yourself and other people who like actually have reporting for the mainstream, like New York Times, like they didn't want to know that much, except a handful of reporters. They knew what was going on. They just were following orders effectively. So we ended up making it for the public because we realized there was a massive information gap. And in February, we released 1,000 decks and they were gone in 3 days. And in July, yeah, 3 days. It was crazy because there was so much demand about like this and also educating people. It was about educating people. Why are these people in there? There's information about them and online with the Instagram page attached to it. There was like what their war crimes were, right, which is really important. So people could educate future generations, people right now, parents, frankly, you know, in-laws, like I have to. Like, so, but then we partnered with someone I know, Dr. Ghassan Mabusata, who I know people who follow you know. You know, he's the world-renowned, frankly, reconstructive surgeon. Was working in Gaza at the beginning. Has worked in multiple war zones. Has never seen anything like he's seen. And we're partnered with his children's fund, which is set up a clinic in Beirut. And he basically takes the most affected surviving kids, like people who've lost arms. Because people don't realize when you're amputated, if you want to continue to grow the limb, you have to redo surgery again and again so the bone continues to grow. And children with burns top to bottom. And he does what they can to reconstruct their lives. So he set up a clinic in Beirut to do that. They evacuate people, well, now it's stopped because Netanyahu won't let any more people evacuate, but they were evacuating children up there to help them, give them some sense of normality. So every dollar, every single dollar from these cards goes to him.
That's like great.
And the reason they're $30 is that, you know, people, I want to know that we want to raise as much money. And they've got the best doctors already. Like people have quit their jobs. They're doing God's, I can't think of another word, but God's work. I think it's supplies. It's all about supplies. Like, every dollar they can do provides the aid, the medicine, the bandages, everything that they can get their hands on to make sure that this clinic is the best clinic it can be for those children.
Yeah, and here's the little, you have a cute little graphic. I think that's on your Instagram page. And people want to know where you can get the card, so we'll make sure we put the link in the description. But I want to show some clips of some of these war criminals. Of course, one is, I think an obvious one, right, is Kamala Harris. Wanted you to react to some stuff that she said at the DNC.
America, we must also be steadfast in advancing our security and values abroad. As Vice President, I have confronted threats to our security, negotiated with foreign leaders, strengthened our alliances, and engaged with our brave troops overseas. As Commander-in-Chief, I will ensure America always has the strongest, most lethal fighting force in the world. And I will fulfill our sacred obligation to care for our troops and their families, and I will always honor and never disparage their service and their sacrifice.
Lethal. Lethality. We join a side.
I mean, watching them cheer is the hardest thing.
Yeah.
Watching her speak, I think I've got used to them lying and missing crazy things. Watching an audience of 20,000 supposedly liberal, progressive people stand and cheer that on, and
disgusting.
Lethal, to
yeah.
your point. Like watching them cheer that and think that was a good thing.
Yeah, it's really disturbing.
Like, you know, somebody sent me a meme about it from Europe. It reminded him of the scene where the in Star Wars, where the senator, tried to take the emperor out, and then he turns the republic into an empire, and they applaud the end of democracy. You know, the people there applauded the end of, and it's literally that. I mean, you know, people think about how Trump is going to do this and everything else, and that context was already set, right? But like, we have been losing our rights through Bush to Obama to Trump to Biden, and now Harris will do the same, continue that. Like, we are slowly losing things. And frankly, if, you know, people talk about like this horrible thing of this project in the future that the Republicans are going to do, it's already happening. You know, like people talking about Project 2025, like it's like some horrific thing. I'm going to give Obama two bits of credit. At least under his Justice Department, they would challenge horrific Republican laws that were passed in Louisiana, Mississippi, or Alabama, or Florida. Joe Biden's Justice Department hasn't challenged any of the trans laws that have passed, anti-trans laws. He's not challenged any of the abortion laws. They've not taken any of them to court. And you could say, oh, well, the Supreme Court's not going to help. Challenge it. It can be delayed. Lives are saved when you delay those laws being implemented, right? And to make matters worse, like, they are, like, just ushering in more Republican policies at the border. Like, this is not... This is not your friend. This is not your auntie. This is not your colleague. This is not someone who cares about you. She cares about being president. And she is moving to the right quicker than George Bush. Like, it's mind-blowing. Her policy on Israel is to the right of George Bush. She's the third or fourth most highest funded person by AIPAC. They want her in office to continue to slaughter Palestinians. And the reality is that, like, for a lot of people, the comfort of your of an American life means bodies everywhere else in the world. And that's what they're willing to sacrifice so they can, like, go to brunch without thinking about whether the Republican in office is going to take their laws away, right? The reality is there's a lack of understanding of what's going on around us right now, which is already fascism. Like, we're already living in it. The idea that we're not living in it. We have police, as you know, you and me both live in New York, like, that are unaccountable by any measure. They killed people, as we all know, in the last, since 2020 and before, and they don't get prosecuted, not just by the state or the city, by the Justice Department. We already have unanswerable, unelected people who police us, right? We have that thing. We have laws already being passed to restrict our rights to protest. We have laws that allow us not to say things now about Zionism, not even like about, I don't know, the use of a racial slur, which could be offensive, but Zionism, like, which is a political movement. We are, all our rights are being slowly stripped from us, and the reality is people, when they think of fascism, they think of stormtroopers at the corner of streets. They think of the Nazis. They think of, you know, being watched constantly. Well, we are being watched constantly. The reality is this is capitalist fascism. They still need you to brunch. The only people that disappear in capitalist fascism, frankly, are the people that stand up for everybody else. That's who disappears, because they want noise. They want you to keep spending money so it continues to tick and keeps going, and they can continue to extract from the rest of the world. And that's what Kamala Harris's vision for America is, frankly.
Yeah, it's interesting. So Brad actually just texted me this. Let's play this side by side, because a lot of people, as you know, are saying that, oh, Kamala Harris is a real breath of fresh air. She's not the genocidal Joe that we know. But let's take a look at how different they are in their rhetoric. And this was tweeted out by Zay Squirrel, who's someone who has done amazing research. He's on Twitter, and he's done they've done amazing research on the Hamas rape hoax. So let's take a look at this comparison.
The war in Gaza, President Biden and I are working around the clock, because now is the time to get a hostage deal and a ceasefire deal done.
My negotiators, the foreign policy, intelligence community, and like, have been relentlessly focused, not just on a ceasefire that would inevitably be fragile and temporary, but on a durable end of the war.
I will always stand up for Israel's right to defend itself, and I will always ensure Israel has the ability to defend itself.
Israel will always have the right to defend itself against the threats to its security, and to bring those responsible October 7th to justice. And the United States will always ensure that Israel has what it needs to defend itself.
Because the people of Israel must never again face the horror that a terrorist organization called Hamas caused on October 7, including unspeakable sexual violence.
Ordinary Israelis' whose lives were forever marked by the shattering event of Hamas's sexual violence and ruthless brutality.
At the same time, what has happened in Gaza over the past 10 months is devastating.
And the Palestinian people have endured sheer hell in this war.
So many innocent lives lost. Desperate, hungry people fleeing for safety over and over again. The scale of suffering is heartbreaking.
Too many innocent people have been killed, including thousands of children.
President Biden and I are working to end this war such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom.
A better future for the Palestinian people. One of self-determination, dignity, security, and freedom.
So identical.
He would never have anointed her. I mean, you know their relationship.
Right.
She's best friends with Bo before he passed, right? He would never have anointed her and endorsed her so quickly if he wasn't happy with the fact that she was going to continue his policy work.
Right.
And the horrors they are going off, I know when I tell it's just that they are going off the fact that there is a limited understanding of international law. There's a limited understanding in America of the history and context of what's happened in Palestine. There's a limited understanding of who are terrorists and who are not, frankly. Like, I love the, you know, the continuation of the terrorist Hamas organization. Didn't the United States once call Nelson Mandela and the ANC terrorists?
Yeah.
Didn't they call the Viet Cong terrorists? Don't they seem to call every indigenous movement that wants to reclaim its land a terrorist group, right?
And what about the terrorism of Israel?
Right. So, the reality is only about 30 countries regards them. And the common theme with all those 30 countries are they white countries in Europe and America, white dominant countries. And the reality is they are the ones who treat indigenous resistance movements as terrorist organizations. The only terrorist organization here is Israel and its backer, the United States of America. And the world currently is being held hostage by the US, and that we need to resist at every possible turn on our streets, in our policy, in our work, everything we do to isolate both the US and Israel.
Well, I want to show one more video because we want to be inclusive and we don't want to, erase anyone. So let's show one more war criminal. And this is Matt Miller being questioned by Prem Thakkar.
Really an independent investigation if the alleged culprits are the ones conducting the strike.
So what I said, we thought it's appropriate for the government of Israel to investigate. They have said to us, and again, as I said, I'm not attesting to any of these facts. I can tell you that we intervened with them. They provide us answers. I'm providing them to you. And what they have said is they went to these agencies and asked for information and it wasn't forthcoming.
Sure. So on that note, on you said that the Red Crescent, the UN hasn't provided answers. Will you move to verify those claims?
It is not for us to do it. Look, I would hope I would hope that those agencies can come forward and provide information. It's easy to do so. If in fact they have information, they should come forward and do it and provide it, and we'll be happy to look at that.
So yeah, shout out to that war criminal.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I do think him and his colleagues in the media who just write everything need to be brought up on charges of incitement to genocide. Because,
yeah.
By the way, for people who think that can't happen, just take a look at Rwanda. The biggest prosecution of genocide cases was against the media in Rwanda, right? And Western institutions are not immune from that. So you think you don't like Jake Tapper? If we need to get international lawyers together to go after these people who've worked with Matt Miller and Corinne and other Democrats, spokespeople behind the scenes to craft that narrative to get out to the public, and they can be held accountable.
Yeah, I mean, and one other thing that they've pushed, and this is atrocity propaganda, that's why they talk about the Hamas rape hoax all the time, because they want to kind of like reach people's like lizard brains almost, so that they think that these people have done this, they think they're monsters, and then that justifies everything. And it is so upsetting that they talk about the sexual violence. The DNC platform mentioned it, Kamala mentioned it, and nobody has talked about the actual verified rape that has been documented, that has been on camera, that Israelis have protested for the right to for soldiers to commit that the Knesset member has said is justified. I mean, they are silent on that. These people don't care about rape at all. They don't care about women at all. They don't care about sexual violence. It is pure purely politicized, and it's so disgusting. And the double standard is just so infuriating.
Well, but also using that same trope, they also who else do they use that against domestically? Black men.
Black men, yeah.
Let's just be real. Like, we recently had Yusuf speak at the DNC, which I welcome as someone who's formerly incarcerated, having someone up there with such a powerful story. But continually, the monster man goes back to the crime bill, frankly, and Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden calling them super predators.
Super predators, right.
Black men in America have been subject to that same, they go after your women, the innocent white woman, the innocent woman. And they are subject now, the target predominantly is brown men in the Middle East. They go after our women, like they go and rape them because they want that atrocity thing that's in the back of your head because you've heard it so many times and you've watched it through Hollywood and other propaganda that you've been subject to for the last 20, 30, 40 years. You believe that instantly without any challenge, not the crimes that, the Israelis who literally, as you said, are outwardly protesting for the right to rape.
Right. So disgusting. Yeah, really disgusting. And of course, it was like with Gaddafi, they said that he was giving Viagra to the army.
Yeah.
Same thing. So wanted to just show one more clip. And this is actually something you mentioned that you and I are both based in New York. This is actually something that happened to you in New York City. Here's a news clip about something that put you into the media spotlight yourself.
Investigating a confrontation at Lincoln Park as a potential hate crime. The alleged victim says that he was accosted because of the color of his skin and the scarf he was wearing. CBS 2's Naveen Dhaliwal has the story from Fort Greene.
As Ashish Pershar stands near Edmund Park.
I don't even know if I'd registered how bad it was at that moment.
You and your son go away.
Why?
It's unclear what led up to the moment before the video, but the attack is caught on camera.
Get away!
A woman went on a rampage Tuesday morning as Pershar shielded his 18-month-old son on the basketball court.
She told me she's Jewish American and I don't belong here.
That's how it started. Then the woman throwing more insults.
You're a terrorist. You don't belong here. She told me several times that I didn't belong here.
Pershar stunned as things got worse.
She threw her phone viscerally at both our heads. And I ducked and it missed both of us. And at that point, I put my son on the ground behind my legs. And when I looked back up, hot coffee was coming towards my face.
Nearly missing his son.
She targeted me because I'm wearing a Palestinian scarf. I'm wearing an Arab scarf.
She stopped once a bystander against the fence stepped in. Pershar, whose family is from India, is appalled that he has become another case of mistaken identity and a victim of a possible hate crime because of the color of his skin.
I'm Punjabi. I was born in London. But it doesn't mean I don't have solidarity with anyone in the world who is seeking to be free.
And after the two recent hate crimes in the Sikh community, one fatal, now he wants local leaders to address the bias louder than ever.
It's been carried over from everyone from India to North Africa and the Middle East in the middle. We're not safe. Simply that. And our children are not safe.
Pershar says he's never seen this woman before, and now police are investigating this as a possible hate crime. So far, no arrests. In Fort Greene, Brooklyn, Naveen Dhaliwal, CBS 2 News.
So can you update? First of all, really sorry that happened. And how old is your son?
He's two and nearly two and a half now, but he was 18 months at the time.
18 months.
18 months.
And can you update us about this case?
Yes. So I did a grand jury appearance. It moved really quickly. She was arrested. She surrendered, frankly. And I have to thank New York, frankly. I don't think there wasn't a mom in New York or parent that didn't mobilize to try and find her. Like there was posters from Fort Greene to Grand Army Plaza that had nothing to do with all over looking for her, taking screenshots from the video that I posted. I owe New York so much in the public, but she surrendered because of that, not because of the police. She surrendered because her world was getting small. Someone found her in Whole Foods, put a photo out, tagged the NYPD. And I think she just had to surrender. So she surrendered. 2 weeks after it happened, it was November 7th, so a month after October 7th. She surrendered 2 weeks later. I did a grand jury appearance in December. They found her unanimously that it had to go to trial. And since then, it's just been court appearance and she changed lawyer. back and forth. We should find out soon if she wants to go to trial or take any prospective deal that the District Attorney of Brooklyn offers her. You know, this is also complex for me. As you know, as someone who's been in prison, I don't believe in prison, right? I'm an abolitionist. I don't think prison is going to be good for her or any other person involved in this. Like, we've healed as a family. We don't, you know, I have, you know, the reason people know, the reason I wear that scarf isn't because of what's happening now. I was gifted it by a Palestinian mother in 2011 when I worked in the West Bank, who said I would do the right thing before I resigned. So that scarf has a lot of meaning to me. Where my son was wrapped in it when he was born. That's how much meaning that scarf has to me. So, you know, when someone does something like that to you and believes in you, there's a connection and you take it with you. This woman, hopefully before September or in a week, will know if there's going to be a public trial or whether the DA offers her something. And look, I don't really think jail's great, but she wants to go to trial. I can't see, I mean, you never know with a trial, but like everyone who's watched that video, forget what my race is or my scarf is. The idea is they see a toddler.
Yeah.
And she attacked him. She attacked him. And the reason people are like, are you sure it wasn't just you? And like, you know, look at the way Israelis are attacking Palestinian children. Mm-hmm. And she's Israeli, Jewish. Israeli? Like, she's wow. Israeli. She's Israeli. She's a dual citizen. So she went for my child. The second object was definitely targeted at my child. The direction, she wasn't a bad throw. She knew what she was doing. And, you know, she said the comment, I think it's in all the coverage of New York Mag and everywhere covered it, which, I hope someone burns your child. And then she attempted to do it. So I have no doubt that she tried to target our little toddler, you know, at the time. Okay. But I said back then, like I said on camera, but also I went further. I was like, what a lot of media edit out is I blamed President Biden for the environment that we had built. For the first month of this, Palestinians were demonized here. Anyone who was looked like them was demonized here. And, you know,
the beheaded babies lie that he put out, despite the fact that his own staff told him it wasn't true.
100%. And I said on one of the interviews, I think Pix 11 didn't edit it out, that like more people will be attacked. More people will have worse outcomes than what happened to me and my child. A few weeks later, those boys were shot in Vermont.
Right.
Like, and he hasn't called them. The president still hasn't called them. If you are showing what our administration, what Kamala and everyone else believe in, this is what they believe in. Violence towards the oppressed, ironically, in this, and empowering the oppressor, whether it be Israelis in the streets of New York or Israelis in or the Israeli occupation in Palestine.
Well, Ash, thank you so much for joining, and really want to thank you for participating, how generous you are, you've been with your time, and please come back, and we'll link to all your projects in the description.
Thank you. Appreciate you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Have a great night. Well, that was amazing, inspiring, obviously also upsetting, and we're going to keep the show going, and we're bringing on our next two guests. Nadia Ahmad is a DNC delegate from Florida, DNC Interfaith Council co-chair, DNC Women's Caucus Executive Committee member, part of Delegates Against Genocide, and a law professor from Orlando. She's also part of Ceasefire 2024, and she's filed a complaint with Chicago police against the Democratic National Committee over the Islamophobic attack she experienced at the Democratic National Convention, which we'll get into shortly. And Lauren Steiner is an activist, organizer, and independent journalist based in Asheville, North Carolina. She's fought against fracking, the climate crisis, education privatization, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, and for net neutrality, clean energy, Medicare for all, racial, economic, and environmental justice, and Palestinian human rights. On her internet show, The Robust Opposition, she interviews organizers, activists, authors, and progressive elected officials and candidates. So welcome, Nadia and Lauren.
Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
Of course. So, we're going to show this video of what happened to you, Nadia. We have two videos actually capturing this moment. But before we do that, and in fact, we showed this last week to viewers. We talked about this last week. Before I do this, both Lauren and Nadia, tell us about the context, how you planned to do the protests that you engaged in at the DNC.
Well, I had been contacted in April about trying to approach all the 50 states' Democratic conventions to get as many Biden delegates to flip to uncommitted as possible. It was a big effort, and I contacted Davita Ginsburg from If Not Now, which is the group that I organize with, along with Jewish Voices for Peace, to see if she would help me. And she said they don't do electoral work, but she put me in touch with two people from the uncommitted movement, Abbas and a guy by the name of Seth Woody from Momentum Strategies. And they said, Woody called me and he said they didn't have the capacity to do the 50 states. They were just concerned about the 12 uncommitted delegates that they already had, keeping them through Chicago. So I kind of dropped it. It was too much of an effort. Fast forward to like the first week in August, I get called by a friend of mine who's a Jewish Biden delegate from New Mexico. He tells me the uncommitted folks in his state wanted to know if he would go to the convention and try to get as many delegates as possible to vote no on the platform because it had a very bad ceasefire plank. And he asked me what I thought of that idea. And I said, well, why don't you do a disruption like we did in 2016? Because I, as a Bernie delegate in 2016, I organized this TPP disruption where as soon as the first person from the platform committee came to the podium and said the word platform, we had a mic check, and then we all started shouting no TPP for several minutes. And it was very successful because we had like 2,000 Bernie delegates there and most of them participated. So I immediately called, he said he would do it. So I immediately called Nadia, who had been on my show with Ryan Grimm the first week in July, because they had, this was even before Biden dropped out, because they had both written articles saying that there should be an open convention. And I knew about her work with, you know, Ceasefire 2024. So the two of us decided to try to contact all the people that we knew to see how many delegates we could get to do a disruption like this. And our goal was to try to get 30 delegates. And over the next 10 days, we couldn't get the people because we found out that a lot of the ceasefire delegates who had been elected in their local districts were nixed by the Biden campaign from coming to the convention. They didn't want to have any protesters or agitators. So we got maybe about 10 people, but slowly they started dropping out. The person who contacted me from New Mexico, somehow his state party chair got wind of it and actually said to him, if you do this, we're going to take your credential. You're not going to be able to come back to the convention, and you're not going to be able to do anything in the Democratic Party in New Mexico ever again. And so he feels like he wanted to be able to influence young people, so he bowed out. And then we had some friends of Nadia's in Texas who said they would do it, and then they bowed out. And then we had some people in Washington state who were Jewish, and then they bowed out. So we were down, like the day before this first day when Biden spoke, we were down to like four people. And I just said, all right, we'll just do a banner. And I was at a PDA event. I literally stole, whoever I stole this from, I apologize. I saw a white sheet, I nabbed it. And then I was going over to the Abandoned Biden conference. Well, actually they were relaunching as Abandoned Harris. And I called Omar, who was in our group, not a delegate, but a supporter. I said, Omar, go get some paint. We're going back to the original thing. It's going to be Stop Arming Israel. See, we figured we wanted to start with that, but then we changed to Ceasefire Now because we thought Kamala's for a ceasefire, Biden's for a ceasefire, 78% of Democrats are for a ceasefire. Maybe if we chant that, people will chant with us. But once we knew we couldn't chant because nobody would hear four people in a room full of 4,000, we just decided we were going to hold up the banner with what we really wanted to say, which was stop arming Israel. And I painted it. We went back to Nadia's hotel room. I painted it there. And then we blew dry it. We took a hair dryer and blew dry it. So when she put it under her, it wouldn't get smeared. And we went into the bathroom and I gave Brad a photo of this. So if you want to show it.
There's Nadia sneaking it under her dress, right?
Yeah. And she kind of put it down her pants. And she actually had her daughter there. And her daughter was dressed up in this beautiful outfit. So we figured, you know, who's going to bother a Muslim woman in a hijab with her cute daughter with a beautiful outfit? and they got in, and I'll let, you know, Nadia take over the story from here.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it was a little bit nervous. I was a little nervous walking in. So you're nervous, but then you have to look calm as well, right? Because if you look nervous, you'll get detected. And then when we got through security, it was, that was the moment like, okay, now this is going to happen. But then we had to wait. We weren't sure exactly what the schedule was. We wanted to disrupt during when Biden was speaking. And then there was a surprise around 8 o'clock, Vice President Kamala Harris ended up speaking as well. And so our plan kept getting delayed. Like our goal was, we had contacted some of the reporters in advance, was about 2 minutes into Biden's address, we would disrupt. And so we started counting down, but then people just kept applauding when he was there. So then I think we ended up doing it like a few more minutes into it. And we thought, okay, we're going to have the sign ripped off and taken away from us. And that'll be the end of it. They may take us outside or arrest us. But whatever's like, we were prepared to handle that. But in all the contingencies that we had, because we were on the floor. And so when we're on the floor, only the people who have access to the floor are allowed to it. So my daughter wasn't able to be on the floor. I had to send her with a friend. And when we got to the floor, it's just like this like sheer euphoria for Biden. All of us were really kind of disgusted by that, because this is essentially like a rubber stamp on the genocide that is happening in Gaza. And when we decided to unroll the banner, it was really like, I think we were down to like, I'm going to do it a minute. And then Liano told me, no, we need to do it within 10 seconds. And so then countdown 10 seconds. And then I held up the banner, and it was, and then started counting again, hold it up for a minute or two and do that. But then I just kept counting and counting. And then in the meantime, the banner is like humongous. It's like a bed sheet, right? And I'm tall, but not that tall. And so I had to hold it over my head essentially to make it visible. And then as they were doing all this, I saw from the side of my side that they started handing out very rapidly these "We love Joe Biden" signs. And as they were handing out those signs, they were using those signs to block our sign. And they were doing a good job of that. Then they also started handing those signs out in the back where they had the box office, where the people who attacked me were seated. And I didn't even realize what was happening because I can't see in front of me and the people are attacking me from the back. And when I went back is when I really saw what was happening. I didn't know the sign was being used to attack me. I just like could feel something. And the first few times they hit me, I kind of fell forward and like fell into my chair. And then like our goal was to just hold the sign no matter what until they take it away. Like in that plan, like in the adrenaline and the energy of it, there wasn't a plan when people start hitting you on the head with the "We love Joe Biden" signs. Like that just wasn't like planned. And we were just kind of like, I was like laser focused on just holding the sign at all costs. And when they started hitting, I was just like, okay, just stand up again and then do that. And then they started hitting again more. And then a short while later, they kind of just ripped the banner away from us. But this we thought would happen in a minute or two. It ended up being closer to 4 minutes. Wow. Because what they did is they actually dimmed the light. So we couldn't even see, nobody could see what was happening. Like they were trying to cover it up. But then in covering it up, they actually made it worse because they started hitting me. And then also when I looked over at the footage that that Prem Talker had taken from Zatio, he actually showed, and Akilah Lacey, also from The Intercept, had also taken some of the footage along with Ryan Grimm at DropSite. And we could see later on that like the governor of Illinois is sitting in the box right next to them, along with like the DNC staff and the top level officials from the Harris campaign. And they just looked. And what really made me annoyed is like the governor of Illinois, as he saw this happening, like he's watching, like he's looking literally at it. And he just looks away and then starts looking back to what Biden is saying. It's like he doesn't care. It's like no bystander training or concern at all.
Well, let's show you guys unfurling the sign, and then we're going to show you getting hit on the head, Nadia.
Possibility. Fair. Possibility. We're in the grip of a once-in-a-century pandemic. Historic jobless. Calls for racial justice long overdue.
The So that's them trying to block your sign with their signs.
And that's where they're hitting me.
And it will show another angle of them hitting you. Okay, you can see the thing moving. That's the guy hitting her with his sign. Okay, now let's show the other one where you see you're getting hit in the head.
How will we have to meet? What did I told you then? Witcher apparel.
So again, let's just watch it again. You can see. You see? There it is.
How will we have to meet?
So, I mean, what did you think when this first happened? Like, what did you think was actually happening to you?
I had no idea. Like, I had no idea a sign was being used. I just felt something just like hitting on the head. I didn't know what it was. And then my mom asked me, I was like, why didn't you turn around and stop them or do that? And I thought, well, if I did that, then my sign will fall yeah. down. And I really wasn't thinking. And I was also worried, like, what would happen? Like, if I turned around, then I may lose control of something. And it's also like you're in a really tight spot. So even to like turn around in that spot, you can like lose your balance right. and as well. So I didn't know what was worse, is to like kind of fall, because I'd already fallen one time. And I just don't really think about what's happening completely rationally. You're just trying to kind of get done. And when the security actually came through, it's not as if they escorted out. It's because Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! was there with photographers and videographers as well. And they also, I think, had at least two camera people there. And so when they realized it was Amy Goodman and Ryan Grimm there, what they started doing is basically blocking their cameras with other signs. So not only were they not letting us exercise our First Amendment rights, they were also inhibiting the freedom of the press, and that both of them were like credentialed. And it's just like completely unbelievable. And when the police finally showed up after like 3.5-4 minutes, they were starting to take Liana down, because the woman who was sitting next to him.
And that's one of your fellow protesters, right?
Right.
One of the other delegates yeah. who happens to be Jewish.
Yeah, no. So there was actually another Muslim delegate who was from California, who was also part of this, and he had brought somebody who was a state either a candidate or somebody who was elected from California, and she actually had a baby with her. So that was like another decoy that we had. But once everything started getting violent, then like they had to leave right away, because it's like literally a baby. But they don't care. They don't care. So they left right away. So then right next to Liano came another woman, and this woman was starting to get aggressive with him to try to cause an altercation. And so this woman that was there, because she was causing the altercation, that's why security wanted to remove them. But by that time, Amy Goodman was there, and she was asking Liano questions. And so I remember the security officer saying something to the effect that you need to come down because we're scared that somebody may fall down. Because it's just kind of at a steep angle. And so he said that, you know, you can go outside and answer your questions. So Liano left, followed by this slew of reporters and videographers. And Isamra and I were just like left standing there because they didn't remove us. We didn't do anything wrong. We just held up the sign. And in fact, the people who were hitting us from behind, they didn't do anything to them at all. And it was just like completely like surreal that this was happening to us.
And Lauren, where were you when this was happening?
I was in Nadia's hotel room. And it was hysterical because we were told, I read that Joe Biden was going to be on early and that Hillary Clinton was going to have prime time. So I guess, I don't know, maybe he was offended by that and they put him in prime time. But
he wanted to prove that he could stay up
yeah,
late.
Yeah, exactly.
That he wasn't sundowning.
It wasn't past his bedtime. So I was getting, yeah. you know, really antsy. And I had all these reporters. I should give a shout out to Melissa from Code Pink because she was helping with the publicity.
Oh, yeah. Go read
she had sent press releases to everybody, and she had what she called friendlies, who were, you know, Prem Tucker from, he used to be with The Intercept, now he's with Zateo, and Akilah Lacey right. with The Intercept. I was in touch with Ryan Grimm from Dropsite News directly. And somebody from Al Jazeera and Democracy Now! So basically, I told Melissa, when we figured out this plan, I said, make sure they get to the Florida delegation, you know, for Biden's speech. And that's all we told them, because we didn't know. And the same thing with the AP person. I had the AP person calling me because she had met Nadia at the Vanden Harris press conference. And what she did wrong was she, and this went out to all the, she, you know, AP is wire service, so all the people picked it up. She called them abandoned Biden protesters. And I had to contact her and say, why did you say that? They're not abandoned Biden, they're Harris delegates. Second of all, they're not protesters, they're delegates. You know, it, she almost made it look like protesters got into the hall. And that's not the story. The story is they're attacking their own delegates. And that's what Akilah right. Lacey, in her long article on it, was able to get right and to show how tone deaf that was. And then these guys were on Democracy Now! The next day. And Isam was talking about, because he's Egyptian. He's an Egyptian immigrant. And he's been in this country like maybe 2 years. He's actually a professor. He was at Wesleyan. I don't know if you knew that. He was at Wesleyan teaching political science, and now he's starting at Cornell. But anyway, he was in an Egyptian jail because he was running against the, you know, the military dictatorship. He was in the opposition party. So that's what military dictators do. They jail you. And as soon as he got out, he fled to the United States. So he was telling Amy Goodman how, you know, here I'm going to the land of the free and the home of the brave. I sort of put this line in his head, actually. But you're not really free, because the irony is here you have the Democratic Party who's running on democracy versus fascism. And they're the ones who are, you know, beating delegates over the head with a sign that has the word love in it, for merely expressing their First Amendment rights to stop a genocide. I mean, the irony is so thick you can cut it with a knife.
Yeah, you can't make it up, the metaphor. And Nadia, tell us about who participated in this attack on you, because you have you tweeted out a formal complaint that you filed against Jamie Harrison, who's the chair of the Democratic National Committee. And you go through the individuals who participated in that. Can you talk about who they are? We can also show that on the screen if you want that. Yeah, here we go.
Yeah, sure. You're welcome to share the message that I shared on the tweet. So the complaint was to Jamie Harrison as the chair of the Democratic National Committee. And we were actually told to file the complaint. And so I specifically named the people who were assaulting us. They were Brent Booker, Michael Sabatini, Michael Hellstrom, Oscar De La Torre, and Scott Gustafson. And Scott Gustafson was actually the one who first started hitting me really hard. And then one of the Michaels started hitting as well. And then Brent Booker also partook in that. And then the other Michael and Oscar, they were actually part of kind of really violently pulling away the sign at the very end. And so on Wednesday, I went and filed.
And this is, by the way, this is the Labor's International Union of North America.
Right. And what one thing that's interesting is that is actually the labor union that it was sponsoring the DNC. And they had a big box office suite for them. And the way we were able to identify it is because on their box office, the seats had orange covers, like bright orange covers, and none of the other box offices had that. Like they were very proud in portraying that they were sponsoring. And in fact, it was even on the lanyards that are handed out to all the delegates. Like Launa is actually listed on there. Like it's Launa and then DNC, like on all of the lanyards that were given out. So they were like a big sponsor in all of this. And what I felt is when the next day, when they took away my credential, just I was the only one who had actually been... who had any action taken. It wasn't done on behalf of the DNC. The DNC actually has a spokesperson on record saying that there was no revocation or impact to my credential. It was basically the Florida Democrats at their discretion deciding they didn't want to have me on the floor again. And the reason they didn't want to have me on the floor again is because I would identify those people because they would be seated directly behind me. I also didn't feel safe going back there. And so I didn't feel safe going there with my head again turned to them sitting in that same area. So I think I'm just kind of left with having to file an official complaint to the DNC, which they haven't really done anything about. Progressive Democrats of Florida had also followed up. But really, it's just like horrifying that and even like Ash, who was just on a little while ago, you know, talking about like these types of like horrific violent crimes, and nothing's done about it. I mean, and the governor of Illinois is like looking on as it's happening, and just nothing.
Also, I mean, this is a pretty newsworthy story, and I haven't seen anyone outside of progressive and alternative media bringing this up at all. Has anyone approached you from any corporate media?
They've approached me, but they haven't covered it.
Right.
Well, CNN, Jake Tapper, and Abby Phillip did do something. I was really impressed. They didn't show the hitting. I don't know that they were aware of the hitting, but Jake Tapper introduced it like, you would not have seen this if you were watching this on network TV, but here's what happened. So they
showed the protest banner. Yes. He showed the banner. Okay.
And I love that because Abby Phillip was the one. I never tire of telling this story. I'm sure you remember it, Katie. When during the debate, she says to Bernie, why did you tell Elizabeth Warren that a woman couldn't be president? And he said, well, I never told Elizabeth Warren a woman couldn't be president. And she turned right to Elizabeth Warren and says, how did you feel when Bernie Sanders told you?
It was beyond infuriating.
His answer. Yeah. So she's like, I'm not a big fan of hers. So I was pleased to see at least she did this, you know?
Yeah.
And somebody actually told me that the reason why they were kept handing out all the signs to hide our sign was because Jake Tapper was actually looking directly at us because he was seated right in front of us. And so they were concerned that he would catch, like he would see it. Like he had already seen it. It was a matter of if the news would actually pick it up, and they just did a horrible job of managing that.
Right. Well, I want to show a clip. I want to contrast what happened to you because, when I showed this last week, I said, "Can you imagine if this happened to someone in a yarmulke? Like if someone hit someone wearing a yarmulke with a sign? I mean, it would be discussed as an anti-Semitic attack in headlines, and you know." Nonstop media coverage. And I want to contrast what we saw happening to you, where you're obviously hit on the head intentionally by someone and you're wearing a hijab, and that didn't get any mainstream coverage, but you got tons of mainstream coverage of this Jewish student who claimed that she was stabbed in the eye. So yeah, then she goes, ow, ow, my eye, and then winds up on Piers Morgan and wall-to-wall media coverage.
Well, you know, CNN has to have their stories about this conflict. I put conflict in, you know, or war approved by Israel. And, you know, I think it was Wolf Blitzer used to work for the Jerusalem Post. Yeah.
And APAC too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really horrible. I mean, what I'd like to see more exposure of is the Anti-Defamation League, which was removed. Was just called by Wikipedia unreliable source. Now, Wikipedia isn't exactly a bunch of lefties, you know?
Right.
And they said because, and I knew this from the beginning, because that Jonathan Greenblatt, who's horrible, he's having a revolt amongst, even within the ADL, people don't like him.
Right.
Because he's calling every single Free Palestine protest an anti-Semitic incident. And of course, they don't cover the fact that, you know, half of the organizers are Jewish. Half of the participants are Jewish. And that's why, you know, I support, if not now, and Jewish Voice for Peace, because they've been doing so many great actions to bring attention to this. You know, and me being Jewish, I think this is the worst thing that's happened in my lifetime. Not that there haven't been worse genocides with more people being killed in like Rwanda or Cambodia, but this is the first one that's happened with my tax dollars in my name. So, you know, I'm getting a lot of flack now for people who, you know, I'm not voting for Kamala Harris. I'm voting for Jill Stein, and I'm in a swing state. And I'm getting a lot of flack on Facebook for that because, you know, they all have Trump derangement syndrome. They all think that, you know, this Project 2025 is going to come to fruition. I can tell you that Trump does not have the attention span or the discipline to implement a 900-page blueprint. And also, you know, they also say that he's going to be worse. Well, how can he be worse than somebody who is funding, supporting, and arming a genocide, you know? And they're the ones that are in power right now. And for her to say that she and Joe are working around the clock on a ceasefire deal is such an obvious falsehood. The only thing she's working around the clock on is trying to avoid a media interview where she'll be confronted on her views. And I actually did a protest of her back in 2019 at her Beverly Hills fundraiser. And, you know, we were standing right outside the house. This is one of my more creative ones. We can only get a handful of people at the last minute. So what I did was I printed up a sheet, a flyer on her horrible racial justice record, you know, in all of her years and her horrible racial justice record. And I will put the link to something called Kamala's Receipts, which was compiled by somebody on Twitter who was chased off Twitter, but the document still lives on WordPress. So I will link this. It is the most comprehensive compendium of her record yet. And so we were handing this out. We dressed nicely. We left the megaphones and the signs in the car. And we were handing this out to the fancy people that were coming. This was Jeff Shell, the president of Universal Pictures. And Kamala was just on Rachel Maddow. And both of those, you know, MSNBC and Universal are owned by Comcast. And on her interview, Rachel Maddow said, "I think you are going to be the next Democratic nominee." So they were all working for her. Everybody was taking these things. They thought we were part of the greeting committee. And then finally somebody read it and they're like, uh-oh, we better escort these people directly from their cars to the front door. And that's when we broke out the megaphone and the chants and we started reading the flyer on the megaphone. But, you know, she is only, I was in California for 33 years. The woman has no ideological principles. She shifts with the wind, whatever the political wind tells her is popular. She's only dedicated to her own advancement. And my belief is she will never come out against arming Israel. She's taken $5.3 million from AIPAC, and she's addressed their conference twice. And even if she waits until after the election to do it, she knows full well they will take her out and she will not get reelected. So I think anybody that thinks that she's going to be better because of some weak rhetoric. And, you know, when she said, "I'm speaking," that was a mask off moment. That's what she really thought. It's about her. And even the next day when she said, "I hear you, we're working around the clock, we're ceasefire, we got to bring the hostages home," she referenced the hostages twice, but never said a word about the Palestinians. So, I really feel like it's a very bad environment out there right now. And we're learning, as you know, Katie, what a PEP is, progressive except for Palestine. These are people that I've organized with on a multiplicity of issues, and they refuse to see this for what it is. And it's just appalling.
Yeah, well, Nadia, what are your thoughts on Kamala versus Trump? Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.